Live from the heart of the universe, this is the online edition of the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright lights.
We have tonight's guest, clinical psychologist, humor researcher, and university professor, Dr. Louis R. Franzini.
Look at the night sky.
And performance guest, Jesse Nolan. I am Mark Lejeure, and now our host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
This weekend, this was completely unplanned. Well, a lot was planned this weekend. So this weekend, I was headed to an event where I would be performing. I was driving from where I live to an even more beautiful part of the world, in a very affluent part of the world, Beverly Hills. And that's relevant because at one point, I was the first car stopped at a red light at the top of a hill that is right on the border of Beverly Hills and what we call the Valley here in Los Angeles. So there I was, and being the first car right there at the crosswalk, I could see everything in front of me and all the cars coming towards me. And if I turned my head, I could also see the cars that were very, very close to me as they slowed down before they went down a hill. And so I could see the drivers. And almost all the cars had only one person in the car, that person being the driver. You have to say that these days because there are driverless cars now. So, and after, I don't know why, because I knew this would be a long light. This is known to be a long light. I want to say like 2 minutes, but nonetheless. So I decided I was going to take a moment and people watch. And I was watching the people in all the cars as they went by. And after a while, I noticed something. No one was smiling. No one was laughing. And no one looked serene to me. Now, I was judging and I was making a gross judgment call. But I thought, ironically, these people are coming from Beverly Hills or through Beverly Hills. And okay, some people might have been working and couldn't.
Were you profiling?
Some people might have been working and they couldn't wait to get home or whatever. I don't know. But they could be smiling about that. But there were at least one Lamborghini I saw, several Porsche, at least two Bentleys I happened to notice, at least a half dozen Teslas. I mean, Beamers and Mercedes. There were all kinds of nice cars, too. And I thought, nobody's smiling. And then I had this thought, wait a minute. What are they seeing when they see me looking at them? So I kept my face just as it was, and I looked in the rearview mirror, and I wasn't smiling. I didn't even look like I was smiling inside. I had a scowl on my face, and I immediately excused myself by saying, well, I'm going to this event. It's a high-power event. I've never done anything at this place before, and there's a lot of pressure, and I know this is only afternoon. I'm going to be there until early hours in the morning, and no, Filippo, you're excited to do the event. You're looking forward to performing. This is a great opportunity. You're going to be paid very handsomely. You could smile. And so I smiled, and I smiled all the way to the event, and I said to myself, I'm going to do that, even though it feels weird, all the way home. When after the gig tonight, I drove for about a half hour, and then when I got to that same spot, I remembered saying that, and I remembered I didn't have a smile, not in the inside, not in the outside, and I immediately excused myself in that. Yeah, it's almost 1 o'clock in the morning. By the time I get home, by the time I get to bed, I have to be up by 6:30 at the latest in order to be at the next event where I'm emceeing, and da 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 da. And I thought, no, Filippo, you had a great event. You made a lot of people happy. You were happy. The band was great. I mean, smile. So I guess, like everyone else, or like a lot of people, I had forgotten how important a smile is or a humor is. And I thought, really, nobody was listening to something funny in the car. Nobody was talking to a friend that was being funny. No one was singing to a song that made him smile. No one was having a happy thought. It was a Friday night. Nobody was on their way to a date. Nobody was on their way home. And what about me? What about me? And I had lots of reason to smile. Or maybe, not only that, maybe I'm not talking to enough people that make me laugh. Maybe I don't take the time to talk to the people that make me laugh. Maybe I don't listen to enough funny things. And maybe this show is here to help me today as well.
Wow, yeah, we definitely need help with that. And it's interesting, you got me thinking about my early years and someone that was very unhappy in my world often, which was my dearest mother. And I bring it up because in those years, I couldn't figure out why she had a fake smile on all the time.
Oh.
She had, when she would stress or get focused, she would smile. And then as I've gotten older, we're taught in certain fitness classes or breath work or to put the smile on because that employs the chemicals, and actually, you know, you can't help but start to chemically align with the smile. So that's now I'm right. Looking back, and I think it was a coping mechanism that she was completely unaware of.
Well, and you know, I look at smiles, and so I'm very much aware of what's a fake smile and what's a real smile. And when I actually smiled in the mirror, I smiled.
I say fake, it was like a forced smile. That was right. My point.
But all I had to do was connect to the stuff that made me happy, or and then I'd smile. But then I'd get disconnected right away.
Well, that's why I bring it up, because obviously we need humor, we need more smiles, and really looking forward to tonight's conversation.
Well, our episode is titled How Humor Enhances Life, and actually so much more about life, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. This is episode 867, our interview guest is a clinical psychologist. He's a humor researcher, a university professor, and an author. He is Dr. Louis R. Francini. Welcome, Dr. Louis, to the Life Changes Show.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. How important is it to have humor in our lives?
Very, very important, and probably more so than it exists right now. In my book, How Humor Helps, we talk about humor as a mental erogenous zone. And who knew, but there's another erogenous zone we could tap into from time to time.
Tell us more.
Smiling and laughing are good things. But I would caution a little bit if others don't realize why you're smiling. And if you go into a serious event or you're alone and you're smiling, people may begin to worry about what the stimulus was for that.
Right.
In a car, maybe you were listening to radio or you happen to think of some pleasant event of the past or one coming up. It sounded like you were in that example. But I knew a guy once that he was smiling all the time, and it made me suspicious of him. You know, what's he thinking about? Was he hearing voices that we don't hear?
Well, that's an interesting thing. Is that his problem? Like, maybe he really didn't have a problem, but we have a problem because we don't see enough people smiling, maybe?
That could be. And I might add that he was a psychologist also. So
what did he have to smile about?
For better or for worse. It's funny when you watch people when they're alone. Sometimes people look like they smell something bad. And there's nothing to smell unusual in wherever they are. But better smiling than being grim and appearing angry and so on. So it's a little bit contagious too, the smiling. So that's not a bad thing.
So speaking of contagious, how did you catch this humor bug, so to speak? And when was that?
Well, very early in my life, my father was a humorous guy, and he was regarding his peers and the family and so on. He was always seen as a humorous guy, and as a young child, I was attracted to the Milton Berle show, and I may be dating myself, but somebody's got to date me. I made that up.
Funny.
Burrow and Jackie Gleason and a lot of the early TV guys, and I would watch them quite semi-religiously and enjoy that. And in grade school, we did a little. I did a little act with a friend of mine and for the class, and so it's pretty long living for me. And then I got older and I learned some of the do's and don'ts of using humor, and there are some. Of course. It's been a long time.
So I imagine that you've also done over 20 years of research, I think I read on humor, along with being a clinical psychologist and a professor. So you in the research, you were sharing how it's hard to not necessarily do the research, but get the funding to do the research because people don't take it seriously, right?
And when it comes to other kinds of research, if the university or the government is funding research, remember they used to do that in the old days. But obviously, humor was not seen as serious enough for spending money on when they could look for cures of cancer or signs of this or that disease. So my research was never funded, my research in humor. I did other kind of research also, working with what we called then retarded kids and their learning and so on. And we did have some government research for that. And obviously, on the face of it sounds like a more serious topic, and it was. But humor and its positive benefits wasn't recognized as much as it is today. And I think even your example tonight recognized that humor is a good thing, and it's contagious. Somebody sees you smiling, they're most likely to smile back. I mean, even though they don't know what's stimulating your smile, and it's and not to mention there are physiological effects of using humor and appreciating humor. That the cortisone and other toxic releases from the brain are tend to be deflected by the use of humor, so it can have positive or negative effects in its absence. So I think it's a more important topic to study and research and understand than has been true over the years.
And you mentioned funding for cancer, which of course we agree with. And in your book, How Humor Helps Enhancing Your Relationships, Health, and Happiness. So you're stating that humor helps health. So technically, it's in a similar vein as far as healing or health.
It does, and that's only recently recognized. And I also admit that some of the research that favors that, the positive effects of humor in a physiological sense, isn't that strong a research as most scientists would say. Having control groups, some of the studies, early studies, were all one sex, and looking at some physiological differences for people that were appreciative of humor and those who weren't. In one case of studies, they were examining chemicals in, get this, women's urine, but there were no men's urine samples to compare that with as part of the study. So it's sort of weak scientifically, but it's fairly well recognized with minimal support from hard science and well-controlled experiments that humor can be really a positive effect. And interpersonally, one of the interesting things about it and all the dating apps now, one of the most frequent self descriptions is a sense of humor. And one of the most frequent, one number one or two in the list of things what somebody is looking for in a partner for their life is a sense of humor, an appreciation of humor. So it's getting recognized clearly, but some of the physiological effects, relaxation and reduction of muscle tension and so on, there's evidence for that, but it could be a stronger scientific basis for that evidence, to be sure. So I'm not questioning it and saying that over the years, humor hasn't been funded by the government or even universities very much, and relies a lot on questionnaires and showing films or videos to subjects, and they might rate how they appreciated it, or did they like it or not, and if so, why or not. That's all right. That's a start, but the science of it should be, hopefully will get stronger sooner, and maybe funding for the research would help, so there could be greater samples and control groups and placebo groups and so on.
In your book, you have a lot of footnotes, and you reference a lot of different studies and conversations and public speakers and quotes and all of that. So there, in a sense, you and other psychologists who have also written along these lines, or at least included these things in their book, so or in their papers. So there. There are studies on some level, and you do actually, I should say this, present in the book very scientifically. It's not that it's like a funny read. It's about the study of humor and how it enhances your relationships, health, and happiness, and how serious this is. Now, a lot of people, when they think of funny or humor, they think of a joke. And of course, being humorous and telling jokes are completely different things. But what about the people that are they say, I can't tell a joke, or I'm just not funny? What happens to them in life if humor is so important?
Well, if they keep devaluating themselves, and there are ways to increase your appreciation of humor and how it works. And a lot of it, and especially in my view, is that it's not just joke telling. Tracy Morgan just said the other day, there's a difference between being a funny person and being a comedian. And he said, comedians are just knowing how to tell a joke well, and humorous. And when you're funny, he used Richard Pryor as an example. When you're funny, it's like a way of life for you, he said. And I tend to be more on that side of it. Telling a joke is not a bad idea. I'm not very good at that myself. Maybe that's why I think that. I don't try to remember jokes very well. And because you frequently, wherever you heard it, somebody else might well have heard it too, and it's not going to be original. And the greatest sin you can commit in the humor business is taking somebody else's joke and telling it as if it were yours. And that's not a problem if you're just talking amongst friends that you heard this joke and so on. But if you perform, and that should be original material with you, not a joke that you heard on TV or on a Netflix program or whatever. So there are those kind of rules and regulations. But I like, personally, my favorite is people who are witty and funny and can respond with a unique punchline given a particular situation. And all you have to do is watch the TV, watch the news, watch somebody say something that's unusual or incoherent or whatever. There's plenty to make fun of without making up a sort of a standard joke. Three guys walked into a bar. Usually they might be religious people, a priest and a rabbi and a minister walked into a bar, and the bartender says, what is this, some kind of joke? That's, I thought that was funny too. I don't really tell many jokes. You guys are special to me.
Thank you. Well, I think you just shared something right there that finding, well, there were two things. One is find things to look at to learn, because potentially, like anything else, we're learning AI now, we're learning, you know, different things. We could learn how to be humorous, right?
Oh, yes. In fact, now are seminars that are given. There are camps that you can go away to for a week and learn how to be more funny or humorous. So it is possible to learn. Nobody's born funny. You can learn it. And you can learn it informally by watching comedians on TV and other kinds of folks telling jokes around the family dinner table or whatever. But there are also fairly formal training camps that you can go to or join a club doing improv. There's some formal ways to do it, or you can do it sort of naturally and study up a bit and learn some of the characteristics of humor, when to use it, when not to use it, what topics to avoid, what topics are acceptable. In one of my earlier books, it's called Just Kidding. There's a whole chapter there on the N-word. Some comedians, some African-American comedians, still use it very frequently in their performances. The rule used to be, if you are part of a group, it's okay to make a joke about it or in that context. And when it comes to the N-word, I don't agree. Because I'm afraid that I'm afraid that it desensitizes the society and other people who hear about that. And they hear it so much in performances by some people, Hannibal Buress, Chappelle, and a few others still use it pretty freely. And I think it gets desensitized, and it's a very harsh word, the N-word. That's why they only use this one syllable, or one letter, rather. But it's a harsh word, and I don't think it should be easily bandied about, even in humor. And you can tell jokes about your kids and the guy next door or whatever. It doesn't have to be identified with the N-word.
And so humor is a funny thing, no pun intended or pun intended. So it could get us in trouble, obviously. And so there's a risk there, but it sounds like the more we practice, or the more conscious we get about it or conscientious about it, that it has great benefits. And potentially we all need it, and there might need to be a resurgence of learning how to be humorous. So let's talk about benefits. So in relationships, you talked a little bit about that. You started to talk a little bit about health. Tell us other benefits health-wise.
Well, it's an attraction for people to find good friends and perhaps romantic partners. And it's fairly clear to everybody concerned. And in one of the other interesting thing is there have been some research on this. And people that have been married a long time, many, many years, decades, and people ask them, well, what do you attribute to your long-term relationship? And the frequent answer is their sense of humor is common. That is, it happens a lot. They enjoy comedy together. They joke with each other. They communicate with each other, and in a positive way, not a harsh way. It's a popular explanation, and some of the researchers in just health benefits, lowered blood pressure and lower muscle tension after they laugh, supposedly that sense of relaxation, that not the sense of it, a relaxation after heavy laughter is supposed to, the benefits, health benefits, last up to 45 minutes. This is by people doing research on the medical communities, physiological communities, muscle tension, breathing, the release of hormones in the brain. So there are lots of good medical reasons physical reasons, physiological reasons, that humor is a good thing. And it's a good thing for social reasons. It's useful in businesses, in the workplace. They've done studies which show that when humor is not condemned in the workplace as being a waste of time and so on, you're not working at the bottom line. Absenteeism is down when humor is accepted and a reasonable part of the workplace culture. It's helpful in interviews when you're applying for a job. It's more likely to help you to get promoted than the next guy who's a sourpuss and will take his head out of the computer and so on. So, and there are books on that whole topic, the use of humor in the workplace and how beneficial it is. It's getting more and more acceptance, and it seems to me a book, something like mine, is especially useful because it helps you judge what kind of thing is acceptable in the workplace, or at the bar, or with your neighbor, or with somebody you're trying to meet to date. And there are mistakes you can make if you come on too strong or you get too explicit. Not everybody appreciates a sex joke, and you only met them 10, a minute ago. There's a lot of, even if the material was okay, the setting is not necessarily. You hardly know somebody. You say, "Oh, hello, my name's John, and by the way, did you hear the one where the guy da 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 da?" It's too soon. You gotta, as they say, read the room. Or if you're giving a formal talk, a speech somewhere, and a celebration of winning the Grammy or whatever, it's not necessarily a place for jokes about sex and sexy activities.
So,
Remember that?
you do outline in the book some do's and don'ts, and you talk about some benefits and some of the studies that you do quote, like you said, how the health benefits of laughter can last physically and also in relationship, how relationships last because of humor. That obviously goes for friendships, it goes for work colleagues, and it could work in every field. So what is our next step? Like, as a person, obviously we can each go get your book, which is available on Amazon, by the way, and we'll also give we also have web page information at the Life Changes Show for our guest. You individually, we could do that, but if society is not ready to move in that direction, then we just do what we do and just keep doing it.
Well, society is coming along. Comedy shows are very popular. People are joining improv groups. They're not professional comedians or even in show business, but the improv groups are fun to be a part of. The society is more accepting of it as long as you are socially reasonable and not using off-color jokes with the inappropriate audience and so on. If it's a fraternity meeting, it's one thing. If it's a PTA meeting, it's a different thing. Part of it is not only the style, and you've got to read the room and know what's going to be acceptable and so on, and what won't wouldn't be. And you can't forget the sort of social skills in the sense of being polite and so on. One of the things I do for fun, I used to work in a supermarket, and I'm striking up conversations with other customers in the supermarkets these days. And yeah, I may be helping somebody reach something on a tall shelf or something. Can you still hear?
Yeah.
Okay. I might have bumped something, and I just see Zoom now.
We hear you fine.
Strike up a conversation with a stranger. just for a minute or two and so on. And then maybe I see them some other place in the store, so it's kind of fun for me. And it's and I'm obviously not looking for somebody to date. Well, maybe it's not obvious now that I think about it, but it's true, I'm not. But I enjoy just striking up a conversation with a stranger, and just for no good reason. And they seem to appreciate it and make a comment, maybe something about an item they're considering or whatever. But I'm not telling jokes. That's, I guess, part of my story here. I'm not saying, two cops came in to stop the car last night and da 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 da. You know, there's a lot of setups like that. Yeah.
A lot of what you're saying sounds like what used to be considered being friendly or neighborly or part of community. And and at the same time, some of what you're saying sounds like a skill that one learns in an improv class, like reading the room. Some people aren't used to reading themselves, much less a room. I haven't gotten that far in the book yet. Do you go into how some of this can be achieved?
Well, yes and no. How's that for a clear answer?
Well, you do have three simple habits that can make anyone funnier and more confident, right?
Well, there's more than that, actually. That was just a convenient way to put it. I think that it's important to you read the room, yes. And I'm not even sure improv is a good example or a good way to learn to be funnier or to use humor with strangers or with somebody you would like to have a greater relationship with, a personal one maybe, and a possibly romantic one and so on. Reading the room is important. And the improv to me is, I'm not attracted to it. I've done a little bit of it, but I think it's like jet skis. They're fun for the, in karaoke, it's fun for the performer, but not for the audience.
Okay.
And some of the professional improv people, have gone on to other aspects of humor. But
So let's talk about let's just say three simple habits that we could take away tonight before we move on.
Tell me what you have there.
I don't have them.
Ah.
Tell me the first three that come to the top of your head. Habits that can make anyone funnier and more confident, starting tonight.
Okay. We talked about smiling. Whatever you're going to say, these may not be the three that you're thinking of, but there's dozens. Present your observation with a smile. And that, first of all, if it's presented with a smile, the other person knows you're being friendly, you're saying something potentially funny. It's more likely to be well received when you present it with a smile than with a sober, deadpan face. Deadpan is something for the pros, not for beginners. When you point out, if you're having a conversation with somebody, some well-known person on TV or a politician or something said something absolutely stupid, and you can share that with somebody, without getting too aroused about the politics of it. There doesn't have to be a politician who says something stupid. It's sometimes many of their followers. That's a humorous comment attempt.
Okay.
So look around your world, your environment, wherever you are, for things that are inconsistent or unexplained or seem irrational, and share that with somebody. That's the kind of thing that I favor more than some set-up joke that sometimes the punchline's fairly well anticipated and therefore less funny, consequently. Know who you're talking to. Maybe it's a stranger and you're going to find out. When you present it with a smile and encourage it. The other person's inclined to smile back, and everybody's happy. Nobody feels hurt. Nobody feels attacked. And it's a good way to speak truth to power in more situational things. Interesting thing, I think, in this whole topic is that some people think it's inappropriate, it's anti-religious or something, to make certain kinds of jokes. And I quote people, all the way popes as well as priests who've written books, that humor is very much appreciated by God. And it's okay to make jokes about God, according to Pope Francis, who's now deceased, of course. God delights in seeing funny things happen, funny moments. And you can refer to the book of Jonah. I don't think that's about the whale. They describe joy, humor, and laughter as the heart, quote, unquote, heart of spiritual life. So don't let your religious leader let you avoid humor. I think I mentioned this in the book, that when I grew up, I would be going to the Catholic Church, and there was no humor ever, that in my memory, ever permitted, or the unintentional humor, by the priest and so on. And it was only by visiting priests who were missionaries who used humor in their sermon. And of course, they were there to get extra money in the second collection for their missionary and charity work.
And let me guess, it helped get money, huh?
Well, that's
So I say that because in somebody quoted saying, and it could help with wealth too. So, but you don't say that. You say how humor helps enhancing your relationships, health, and happiness. We have the links at the Life Changes Show page. The book is also available on Amazon. It's Louis R. Franzini, Franzini, PhD, is the author, and he's been our guest today. Louis, thank you so much for making us think.
I appreciate it. And one final comment, I'm quoting Stephen Colbert. He said, making people laugh is an act of love.
Okay, well, thank you for
love. That's a different thing.
and love. All right, well, with that,
thanks for having me, and I hope you guys see the book and enjoy it, and pass it out to all your friends and neighbors at Christmas or Kwanzaa.
thank you. Louis R. Franzini, PhD. It's a funny thing. I think, Mark, how there are certain times that I want to be funny, but it's not appropriate. Then you find out it would have been appropriate. Somebody else says it would have helped. You could have, you know.
But often it wasn't funny anyway.
Oh, what I would have said?
Wow.
Okay. Oh my gosh.
Oh wait, I was serving that up with a smile, not with a smirk.
No, I appreciate that. Actually, you are very funny, and one of the most beautiful thing is to be able to get people. We've been in lots of situations, or I've seen you engage in, and that's bringing. And people say that about the show. It's like, oh, I appreciate you all when you're so funny and this and that.
I've often tried to do that, especially raising my son or, you know, navigating life with him. And I'll never forget the one time that I threw the joke out there. And he said, Dad, you're not going to get me to laugh on this one.
he knew. He
took
knew.
A stand.
Oh, no. Oh, that's brilliant. Well, he's brilliant. Well, with that, we have our Ask Dorothy segment.
Dear Dorothy, this is Jackie, and I just watched a video giving 7 examples of people who don't deserve forgiveness. I've experienced these 7 situations myself and have tried to forgive these people, but have been unable to do so. The hardest person to forgive is my ex-husband, who betrayed me for our entire 7 years of marriage. So is the video correct, and am I doing the right thing by not forgiving my ex and others?
Dearest Jackie, I am very proud of you for looking for answers as to who to forgive and how to forgive. Forgiveness is one of the very best things we can do for ourselves. Forgiveness can set us free. However, forgiving someone who deeply hurt you takes immense strength, and forgiving them may not help you feel better. It is important to know that they might not care if you forgive them. Your emotions right now are actually a very common reaction to your kind of situation. And in the past, I experienced something very similar. And I forgave, and then forgave some more. But my heart still carried the wounds of what happened. It took me 20 years to figure out what true forgiveness is. And now I am free and happy from all of the past trauma. Once I finally accepted that my ex didn't care if I forgave him or not, I had to discover what forgiveness could do for me. After much research, I discovered that the spiritual and emotional work of forgiveness, releasing resentment, deciding not to carry hate, is vitally important to our emotional well-being. However, I also discovered that forgiving someone who doesn't care if you forgive or not, that our heart will still carry the wounds of what happened. That pain isn't a sign that we failed at forgiveness. It's simply a sign that our hearts are still healing from years of emotional injury. It is also an indication that you may be forgiving the wrong person. I prayed for answers, and what I heard was that I needed to forgive myself for giving my power away to others. I needed to forgive myself for choosing to stay married to a man who chose not to be faithful. I needed to forgive myself for continuing to create situations where I ended up being the victim. And, precious Jackie, once I forgave myself, I truly set myself free. Self-forgiveness is an act of self-love. So I lovingly encourage you to do the work needed to let go of your pain and resentment of you not being loved the way you deserve to be. The internet has some amazing answers when we ask the right questions. We're so blessed to have an easy way to find help without leaving our homes. So if you research, how can I forgive myself, you will be led to some wonderful websites with fantastic answers. Verywellmind.com and verywellhelp.com are just two of the great resources that you can use. And I'm happy to help you during your process of forgiving yourself and setting yourself free. Call me or write me if you have further questions on the best way to heal yourself. And call me or write me to tell me how well you are doing.
Thank you, Dorothy. And if you have a question, forgive yourself for not writing sooner and write Dorothy at AskDorothy@LifeChangesShow.com.
And for our performance segment, we are featuring a two-time BMI award-winning producer, singer, songwriter, Jesse Nolan of Caught a Ghost. Welcome, Jesse, to the Life Changes Show.
Hey, what's going on, everybody?
We are so happy to have you, and have to say thank you to Tom Nolan, a man you surely know well and love. And we appreciated having him on the show, very much enjoyed him as a performance guest, your father. So thank you to Tom for introducing you to us.
There it is. Thanks, Tom Nolan, every day.
Well, how much did Tom Nolan actually feed the musical genius that Jesse Nolan is?
Entirely. I mean, my dad is very obsessed with music and always was. And so I had a very musical childhood. I mean, I got to see a lot of really incredible artists, you know, before they passed, people like, you know, Etta James and, you know, Buddy Guy's miraculously still alive. But one of the, like seeing him at the Hollywood Bowl as a young kid was a big transformative experience. And my dad would always give me, you know, like records like Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton records, even before I knew who those people were. And I'd be like, Dad, like I wanted a Nintendo, but it made its way into the consciousness.
I love it. You know, as you're saying this, I'm hearing the interview with your dad where he was saying the same thing about his dad.
Your grandfather.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think it's always our whole family is very musical appreciative, and my mom's dad as well was a huge Hank Williams fan, I know, and used to sing a lot, and actually my dad, when he came home to meet my mom for the first time, and had to meet her parents. You know, he brought his guitar, and he only knew one song at the time, which was Jambalaya by Hank Williams, and he and my grandpa just sang that song all night together. So I think a guitar is a miraculous thing. It'll open a lot of doors.
What a great story.
Anywhere in the world, yeah.
What a great story. Well, you are mainly self-taught?
Mainly self-taught, but I've had a lot of musical instruction over the years. I mean, I taught myself to play piano as a kid by ear. I remember sitting there picking out the Beverly Hills Cop theme song on the piano, and I've just always been attracted to melodies. I was averse to formal music education, I think because I'm ADHD. I just like couldn't sit still, and I didn't like reading music. But I did take jazz band in high school, which was like super formative, and like you have to learn a lot of music theory for that. And then I ended up doing a music minor in college, just because it wasn't a conservatory program, but I knew I needed to really be steeped in theory to know what chord to play next. Basically, you know, if you're a songwriter, it's about problem solving, and just having all that vocabulary really helps.
We talked about this a little bit, how you bridge many eras, and how some of us can hear it in the songs. I mean, we could all say we like it, but we don't know exactly what we're hearing. There's so much in there. Some of it makes us feel like this is brand new, and yet there's something from the past in there, which kind of makes some of it nostalgic. Like how are you doing that, and why? It's obviously important to you. Tell us why.
Yeah, I've always had a lot of interests musically. I mean, extremely diverse. I like composing film scores. I like working with string arrangements. I have a very, very diverse musical palette. I grew up listening to rap music, of course, as a kid in the 90s in California. And so a lot of my production is like influenced by that fact that, like, you know, I like drums that hit hard. I like to hear the bass line, you know, but I also, you know, have this real reverence for classic soul, Motown and Stax era. Obviously that came out a lot in my debut album, Human Nature. But I always kind of wanted it to sound like it was like soul remixed, you know, but I'm also like a huge rock and roll fan. Like the Rolling Stones are probably my favorite band of all time. And I think when you listen to their music, you hear so many disparate influences as well. Everything from like, you know, rock and roll to country, to soul, to gospel, to blues. And it kind of like mixes up in this incredible cocktail. And so for me, I just look at it like, you know, colors that you can paint with. And I'm just really enjoy researching music history and having as much of a knowledge of music history as I can, so that I kind of know when I'm, you know, where I'm pulling from and why, from a storytelling standpoint, so that hopefully the listener has the same emotional experience as I do. I know we're all coming as listeners at music from a different perspective, but I just like to kind of, it's on purpose, I guess, is what I would say.
You mentioned Human Nature. That's the album, right? Is that the one where
Correct,
you got all those sync placements?
Correct, yeah.
So I have a lot of friends in the business. I mean, I have a couple songs in movies and things like that. But to have one album do over 100 sync placements?
Yeah.
What? Tell us about that.
It was astonishing. I didn't plan it that way. I had a good sync rep, Zinc Music, shout out. And I had given them, you know, 5 songs when they signed me. And they were like, yeah, Marisa over there was like, hey, we think you can work with this. It's got the horns do really well for sync. And it has a kind of a, you know, retro, like kind of like classic vintage vibe, which does well. And, but it's, you know, deliberately produced to be fresh, and so it kind of just happened to be work. It wasn't what I was thinking about when I was making it, except I guess you could say that I think cinematically when I'm writing. And the one song that they didn't think they could work with, they were like, oh, I don't know, we'll see, is the Can't Let Go song, which ended up being the theme song for Amazon Prime's Bosch and ran for 7 years. So that was a funny thing. But it was just a weird fit. Like it had no, that song had no other syncs, but it was just perfect for that opportunity. So, you know, I think it's been really cool. I feel very, very fortunate because it was a big driver of audience, you know, people Shazamming the songs on TV shows, everything from Suits to Grey's Anatomy to Vampire Diaries to Boardwalk Empire, you know, all these places that the
Very
music was
cool.
appearing. And yeah, so I think it's cool. You know, sync can be a really valuable part of a musician's business, and so obviously that is on my mind, you know, when I'm working a little bit. But I these days I try to not let it drive my creative process too much, because I think the most important thing is just like making a great piece of music, and not trying to necessarily write it for sync, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. Do you dream in stereo?
I do dream in
Seriously.
stereo.
So that's the song we're going to hear. That's the title. But is that where it
Yes.
comes from? You actual have that experience?
Well, no, not so much. I just love that. I mean, for me, this was a song about searching. You know, I took a lot of time off of music when the pandemic hit. I started a tech company with some people that I was fortunate enough to meet, because my heart was broken. I couldn't perform, and that was really something I was like really needed to redefine myself. So I spent a lot of time away from music, enough to really appreciate what it means to me. And as I'm coming back to music, I feel like I'm just on a journey. So this song is about somebody who's on a journey.
Wow. And this is from Human Nature?
No, this is from this is brand new. No one's heard this. It's unreleased.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so
Oh, wow.
I just wanted to take this opportunity. I struggle with procrastination and perfectionism. So the fact that we were doing this interview was very fortuitous. I love a deadline. I said, "Hey, this is a great opportunity to share this with some people and get some feedback."
Wow, exciting. So here is world premiere of one of Jesse Nolan's of Caught a Ghost, pre-recorded song here for the first time ever in the world on the Life Changer Show, Dreaming in Stereo.
There it goes.
Tell me everything you want.
There it is.
Hey.
Caught a ghost. Jesse Nolan and his brand new song, Dreaming in Stereo. You could find Jesse on all the socials at Caught a Ghost, just like it sounds, or you could go to caughtaghost.com and learn about his music and all kinds of other stuff that he's doing. Jesse, anywhere else they need to go for your music?
No, that's cool. Yeah, like Instagram and YouTube. I took a lot of time off of social media for my mental health for a while, but I am back and posting again. So happy to interact.
You know, actually, I'm glad you said that, because I was going to say, so happy to have you on the show, period. And love your music. And I love that you know where you are in this place and what music means to you. And I think you said it better than anyone I've ever heard say how, as a kid, I used to hear music, you don't choose music, music chooses you. Right.
Right.
And so here you are, you said your heart was broken. And that you didn't get to perform and all that. So I want you to elaborate on that, if you will, but also, how you knew that this is where you needed to be, and that you took this opportunity also to have this conversation with us, even though it's like you don't, your album's not done yet, you're right in the middle of things, you don't have all your stuff ready to go and polished and all that, but you said yes. So we're honored, and so tell us about this moment.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm glad you're digging it. I feel very strongly about the music that I'm making right now, which is like a really great place to be in from a creative standpoint. Like, you're always looking for the juice as an artist. You're always looking for like that hit of inspiration, because it is mercurial. And I've had periods of my life where music was starting to feel like a job, and I was like, where is that, you know, that thing? And like, the better of a producer that I'm getting, the more skills I'm acquiring, the worse my music is getting. Why is that, you know? And right now, I think it's like a sign of a kind of clarity that I have about the kind of music that I want to be making and where I'm drawing inspiration from. You know, it's like a lot of this, I kind of just keep having this visual of like, what if Marvin Gaye in the 70s, around the time that he was making like the cinematic soul, you know, of like What's Going On, was like to take a trip to California and hang out with all the people from Laurel Canyon, you know? That's the visual that I keep getting.
He'd say what's like, going on.
Yeah, you know, like it's all kind of psychedelic, you know, there's a lot of like, you'll hear sitars and strings and horns and kind of like cinematic production all kind of mixed together. And I'm working a lot on my voice. I spent a lot of time last year just singing songs. And so I'm putting out a lot of cover songs and stuff on my socials, you know, in the coming months, because I've just been recording a lot just for the pleasure of doing it. So, this, you know, this idea, this EP is going to be called California Soul, which to me is like a mentality as much as it is anything. People always used to, you know, in press articles, they would talk about Caught a Ghost as Blue-Eyed Soul, which I always thought was kind of a funny euphemism for when there was a white guy singing soul music. It's kind of this like holdover term from the 60s marketing jargon. And I just like, what if I could like, can I define this genre as something new and specific? Because everybody who meets me from the East Coast and stuff is like, yo, you're from California. You can just tell, man. So it's a big part of my identity and a big part of my musical influences and stuff. So I'm just like trying to infuse that. And I've spent all summer going to the beach and swimming in the ocean and like talking to God. So that's where it seems.
Wow. Wow. Well, actually, before we hear this next song, so Caught a Ghost, I got where that came from. I love the story. Do you want to share a piece of it?
Sure. Yeah. Caught a Ghost. It's just an expression that people used to use when musicians were like feeling the spirit. So, you know, I like to sing it like you caught the Holy Ghost kind of a thing, which I think kind of captures what it's like when you are feeling inspired musically.
Oh, I thought it also was tied into the house you were living in Mount Washington. Oh,
well, that's true too. Yeah. formed the Caught a Ghost project when I was living in a house that Danger Mouse used to live in. And I felt like it was like haunted, you know, in a good way. Right. So I like working in haunted spaces, you know?
Really? No, I didn't know. Seriously.
Yeah, no, I think everything carries an energy, you know, the land that we're around, like, as, and so you can kind of tell when a place has a good vibe.
So you're catching a bunch of ghosts, and there's some good music's coming out of it. So this next piece, this has been out for a couple of years, right?
No, this is also brand new. I'm just
What?
kind of, yeah, I'm just sharing stuff because, you know, I'm,
Wow.
yeah,
I guess I
two.
was thinking no sugar in my coffee, but that one we posted as the video of you on our
Yes.
webpage
Yes.
for Jesse Nolan, Caught a Ghost. See it at the Life Changes Show page, but it's also on his YouTube link. So tell us about Out of the Blue.
So Out of the Blue is, you know, it's a song about when life is unexpectedly sweet. And, you know, I think a lot of this music has a kind of a psychedelic flavor to it. So I've been kind of like searching for capturing that transcendental moment where you're like connected to everything at the same time all at once. And a few places in California make me feel that way. One is staring out into the ocean and the other's driving through the desert. So you kind of hear that talked about, and the narrator talks about that as he's with somebody that he clearly loves spending time with in this tune.
Before we play that, you just hit on something that reminds me of what I was catching in so many of your songs. I was telling you that I was sat down to listen and enjoy, and I was, and then I'm like, oh wow, this is deep. Oh, I'm thinking, wow, he's making me think this and that. And so I was sharing that with you, and I said, where does this deepness come from? And here you mentioned that a little bit again. So where is it coming from?
Everywhere. It's all around us all the time, you know. I'm one with God, and God is everything, you know. It is, to me, music is definitely a spiritual practice, and I think it works best when you approach it that way. Like, it's fun, but it is also like it's a way to connect with other people. It is a devotional practice, and it is a social practice, and it is a technological. You know, it's technology. It's the oldest technology that we have humans, as humans have, and it works better than a lot of the technologies that we have forsaken it for, like social media.
Well, let's get to enjoying Out of the Blue. This is going to be part of the new album, right? California Soul coming out who knows when, but you'll let us know so we can share with our audience. This is a world premiere here on the Life Changes Show, pre-recorded, of course. Caught a Ghost, Jesse Nolan's Out of the Blue on the Life Changes Show.
Mindless by the ocean, nightly on the
brilliant. Caught a ghost, Jesse Nolan. Thank you so much.
Thank you, man. Thank you. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you for sharing like you shared and sharing this special music. And, you know, we talked about your grandfather sharing music with your dad and your dad sharing music with you. Is there a little Nolans running around that you're sharing music with?
There's no little Nolans, but my wife is like, you know, my A&R person, you know, she is, it's definitely a family affair. Like she's my biggest cheerleader and I very much credit her with a lot of my inspiration.
Oh, nice. Well, kudos to her and what a pleasure. So this means that pretty soon you and the band will be traveling and touring, right?
I certainly hope to tour in 2026 for sure. We're going to start by doing some stuff in Los Angeles, I'm sure. But, you know, I think, I don't know. I think at this point, follow along on Instagram is probably the best place to kind of stay in touch. I really want to kind of build this in public this time. I think I had a different mentality back in the day about like, all right, I got to just do this mysterious music thing and then drop the album. And now I just feel really kind of open about sharing my creative process and everything that I'm going through around it. So
obviously like you did here tonight with us, thank you so much. So on Instagram, that's Caught a Ghost, just like it sounds. And then caughtaghost.com. And then, the YouTube channel as well. It's Caught a Ghost. Well, and then we have links at the Life Changes Show page, if you didn't catch that, for Jesse Nolan, N-O-L-A-N, of Caught a Ghost. What a pleasure. All the best to you and look forward to hearing more of your music and more from your camp.
Thank you, Filippo. Cheers, brother.
All the best to you. With a big thank you to Dr. Louis R. Franzini and another big thank you to Jesse Nolan of Caught a Ghost. That is our show. On behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our executive producer and co-host, Mark Legere, and our whole family here at the Life Changes Show, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, reminding you that as your life changes, like ours surely did tonight, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at the Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.